This is News in No Time. Ed Gordon on today's roundtable. John Lee Malvo faces down his protege in court. And do blacks have any power on the Hill? Joining us today to discuss these topics and more with me here in Washington, D.C. at our headquarters is economist and author Julianne Malvo. She's the president and CEO of Last Word Productions. Glenn Lowry is with us. He's professor of social sciences and professor of economics at Brown University. He's at member station WRNI in Providence, Rhode Island. And in our bureau in New York City, Michael Myers, executive director of the New York Civil Rights Coalition. I welcome you all. Greatly appreciate it. Coming out of what we just talked about, Julianne Malvo, and let me start with you, a very interesting list that actually came out last week from Knowledge Is, and it's a... essentially, it is a consulting group for lobbyists, and they have ranked the folks on the Hill in terms of power. Part of their criteria was the position of that person, tenure, committee assignments, influence, legislative activities, and what they called sizzle fizzle factor. It's kind of a pop culture fun thing. We decided to take a look at this to see where African Americans fell. No surprise here. Barack Obama landed at number 68 as a senator. He's relatively new in the Senate and obviously the only African-American there. But here was what was interesting. When we moved to the House, the highest ranking African-American was at number 43. And that was Charles Rangel from New York City. What do these numbers, and we know rankings can be played with, but if we lend any credence to these numbers, Julianne, what does this say?
Well, with the Rangel ranking, and certainly if you looked again at the Conyers ranking, going to your own home city, I think that in Congress there are a number of senior African Americans who are poised to take on significant positions were the House to shift. On the Senate side, you know, Barack Obama is a junior senator from Illinois. He's deliberately cast himself as a centrist. He has a plus 45 voter approval rating, which is important. I mean, whatever the world thinks of him, his own constituency thinks very well of him. He pretty much broke even in the dust-up he had with John McCain. And he has significant committee assignments, environment, foreign relations, and veterans. So that he's 68, to me, is not a tragedy. He has done what people have told him to do, the same thing that Hillary Clinton has done. You come into the Senate playing it under the radar, you get an opportunity to blow, and you blow. He hasn't had that opportunity yet, but he really, I think, has been extremely effective. So I'm not paying very much attention to the numbers. The House side numbers are a lot more important.
Mm-hmm. What of the idea that number 43, again, Charles Rangel being the highest African-American on this list, Michael Myers, some will say that they see that as relatively low based on, A, the committees that Mr. Rangel has been on, and in particular his tenure?
Well, yeah, seniority is the name of the game in Washington, D.C., but also this poll, or should I say this power ranking survey, is really an insider's game. People who know the Congress, people who lobby the Congress, people who have been inside the Congress, they know the game and they know the power circle. And let's face it, the Democrats are out of power. Don't forget that. Besides seniority, you have to be in the majority in either house to really wield power, to get the leadership roles, to get key committee appointments. So even if you're the ranking Democrat, it doesn't mean anything because your party's not in power. Moreover, I think it is interesting, however, that among the people who have been ranked high up, including the factors I said, Sheila Jackson Lee was a Democrat. She ranked 10th in the legislation power category, although she had 152nd overall due to her success in getting amendments considered and things like that. Dianne Feinstein, who's a Democrat, ranked 2nd among Senate Democrats, 11th overall due to her strong legislative record. But publicity hound John McCain ranked 1st in the influence category because he has access to media. So these rankings don't really mean anything, but it's an interesting insider's game, just like the NAACP's rankings and voting records of Congress is an interesting set of data from the NAACP's eyes.
Yeah, Glenn, that's interesting, though. Michael kind of poo-pooed it, but the idea of actually having political clout with the media really takes you a mighty long way. I mean, part of what made Barack Obama Barack Obama was the idea that he spoke to millions through the media and then became a media darling, as we know, during the Democratic National Convention.
That's right. Obama's doing well, I agree, and I think it's interesting. It raises a question about how people actually get represented in our democracy. I mean, we have districts and we have people elected from districts. But in fact, a figure like Obama, quote, represents, close quote, Americans across a broad spectrum, not only the citizens of Illinois. But I think these rankings are really showing us, especially on the House side, the implications of the marginalization of Democrats and of the polarization, the political polarization of the House of Representatives that has happened since the Republicans took control in 1994. It's a less bipartisan place, and it's less a place driven by seniority. I mean, one of the things Gingrich did when he came in was seize a lot of power for a House leadership in terms of assigning committees and moving away from the Democratic traditional way of assigning committee chairmanships based strictly on seniority. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's also the fact that black politicians are marginalized within the Democratic Party. I mean, you know, the current political climate has the Democrats essentially playing this kind of middling policy, and they have to keep their black constituency at some distance from the halls of power if they're going to remain credible with the mainstream of the American people.
But seniority, in the sense that you know the game, you know the players, you know the score, you know how to get around, that kind of seniority is invaluable in terms of influence, in terms of legislative access.
Julianne,
and power.
Real quick for me, I've got to
but
move
you know,
on.
Glenn made a very important point about this whole issue of media, because there's so many African American members of Congress, Ed, we talked about this last week, who are putting stuff out there and they just can't get the representation. I mean, Sheila Jackson Lee, Maxine Waters, I could go down the list. Of the 38 members of the CBC, half of them are ineffective, but those who are effective struggle to get media play.
Yeah, I will also say this, though, and I, you know, and this is a bit of public chastising these folks. Save a handful of them. Many of them don't know how to play the media, even when invited. Often we invite many of them and don't receive phone calls back, et cetera, et cetera. So.
Well, I'll give you that, and you're absolutely right about that, and I've talked to many media colleagues about that, but I think at the same time, there are folks who don't call them.
Yeah,
I mean,
Maxine,
I think
no doubt about that.
This
Maxine
whole Conyers thing on, the Conyers no thing on impeachment, Maxine's thing. So I think we need to make a point about that. So who is doing these rankings and ratings, especially in terms of our people?
All right, let me move on very quickly. A surreal scene here in Washington, D.C. yesterday in the courtroom when we see the D.C. snipers, if you will, Lee Boyd Malvo, the youngest of the two, on the stand talking about how John Allen Muhammad, quote, made me a monster. Julianne, I was here the day they captured these two men in Washington. You lived through this, but it really was surreal to see this happen. And we should note that John Allen Muhammad is representing himself, therefore cross-examining his young
Let me say for the record, it's M-A-L-V-E-A-U-X, not M-A-L-V-O.
No relation.
Just for the record.
No relation.
But let you know, if young Malvo grew white, I think people will be trying to get help for him. This is a young man who was clearly brainwashed by someone that he looked up to, and he bought into this bizarre scheme of killing 30 people a day. I mean, nobody with sense could buy into this. It was literally surreal to watch the two of them go at it with each other. And it was surreal to live here in Washington. Then I remember I lived downtown D.C. and people were saying, don't walk straight down the street, walk crooked because you might get, you know, shot if you walk straight. All kinds of things. The brother from power group in Philadelphia who was killed. There were so many layers of this. But at the bottom line, I think that there is going to be a reckoning here. And the reckoning is this cross-examination that will continue today. This young man has come to his senses and he's really clear that what has happened to him was brainwashed.
Glenn Lowry, here's what's interesting, too. You can use this as a microcosm of, and we should note that role models can be good or bad. When you talk about the influence of adults and men in the lives of boys in this case, here is a true sense of the real influence an adult can have over a child.
Yeah, that's certainly true, and it raises questions of responsibility. Now, this crime was horrible, and the fact that it terrorized an entire city, this was a horrible thing that was done. I suppose it's unthinkable that Malvo could, you know, walk, could ever one day see the light of freedom, and I'm not advocating that. But I'm saying, you know, in the state of Florida, there are over 1,000 people in prison for life without the possibility of parole who committed their offenses when they were juveniles. And what I'm saying is that although this is a tough case and you wouldn't want to make law on this case, the general question of whether or not a 16, a 15, a 17-year-old really ought to be held fully responsible for things that they do when, as you say, parents or other social forces could have a determinative influence on the shaping of their minds and of their behavior, that's a question that we ought to be asking ourselves. You know, vengeance is not the only, it's not the only value that we should be trying to pursue in this.
Michael?
Well, I'm not convinced and persuaded by what Julianne and Dr. Lowry said.
In the sense of what, that he is now remorseful?
You made me a monster. Oh, gee whiz. Look, this reminds me of that great line from the movie Verdict, in which the witness shouts from the witness stand at these hospital ogres. She says, "Who are these people? I wanted to be a nurse." Yeah. I assume that Mr. Lavo wants to be somebody other than a murderer. He's a murderer. He committed these crimes. And, you know, it's a little late in the game for him to plead mental disease or duress or insanity. It's just too late. He was convicted.
Michael, he isn't pleading anything. He simply is facing the
person.
He's
pleading from the witness
stand. He is facing the person who formed him. He is stepping up in a way that is profound. He's not asking for mercy. He is not pleading for anything.
I understand.
I know you are a hard-hearted man. I know it. But
it's
still.
It's not the use of the word plea that I say. I'm talking about plea to the public, not in terms of an actual plea in terms of a...
No, he's already... He's already pled guilty.
I understand
guilty.
He's already guilty.
Well, Michael, let me ask you this. Do you leave any room for the idea that he may have become now a bit more clear-headed at 21? You spent time alone in your jail cell. You had an opportunity to reflect. You are now divorced from the man who had tremendous influence on you. Are you leaving no room for the idea that he's learned his lesson?
He hasn't learned any lesson.
All right.
No. It hasn't been enough time
for him
to have learned
a
lesson.
Let me do this. I've learned my lesson, Michael. When you chomp at the bit like this, I've learned my lesson to move on. Let me do this.
Change topics.
Let me see if we're exactly. Change topics and move on to what we saw. And interesting, and let me, A, congratulate a gentleman that I've known for some time and a fine journalist, Charlie Gibson, who will now sit in the ABC News seat for their evening news. But here's the interesting point, Glenn Lowry, and I raise it because what it has done is we now see that Elizabeth Vargas, who was going to go on maternity leave, is going to step away from that seat, go back to her old job on 2020. And of course, we should note that she was teamed not long ago with Bob Woodward, who was critically injured when covering the war in Iraq. Some will say this gave ABC a great opportunity to remove her from the chair because ratings weren't what they had hoped. And some will suggest that maybe America is not ready to see a female in that seat. I'm sure CBS doesn't want to hear that with Katie Couric's impending move to that chair for them.
I don't see that here. I mean, I think America is ready to see a female in the seat. Though I think who's in the seat and what the qualities are that you want your, quote, anchor to project is a complex thing. And I imagine that gender has certainly in the past played a role, but those things are changing. My reading of this is that Elizabeth Vargas is about to have a child. She has another young child at home, and she wants to spend more time with her family. That's what she says. I take her at her word on that.
Julianne Malvo, obviously conjecture here. Reverse the scenario, had Elizabeth Vargas been injured while covering the Iraqi war and Bob Woodward remained the sole anchor, do you believe that ABC would have said to a male in that seat, move over, we're replacing you with another man?
Oh, not at all. And in fact, Ed, the reason why I love you so much is because you anticipate what I'm thinking. part of this is, frankly...
That's not hard to do.
be quiet, Michael Myers. I ain't talking
about you. All right, people, we're running out of time.
You know, but here's the thing. When is a man going to step down and say, you know, I'm going to step down from my anchor seat because I want to raise my young kids. I want to spend more time with them. That's when you really have gender equity. The fact is that I think she was nudged over because the ratings weren't there. And I think that in many ways, although Glenn is correct in stating that, you know, you have to take her somewhat at her word, the media is not yet ready to take women as equal partners. And that's where it is. The tag team was, I think, flawed from the beginning. How do you go from usually a sole anchor to you got to have a tag team? I think that that really spoke to both the man and the woman that they had chosen. Well, and they're both phenomenal journalists that I think we all respect, but I think that the powers that be in the media had not respected either of them enough to let them sole anchor the evening news.
Well, here's Michael. What I think. This is my
all
advice.
Right, Mike.
Yeah. Look, the ratings weren't there. It's right. And I think ABC panicked. That Elizabeth is no match for Katie Couric at CBS. I wouldn't mind seeing a big-bellied woman on as a TV anchor. I think that would be healthy and good. But she's not going to be a match for the great one at CBS. But, you know, the bottom line is, quite frankly, Charlotte, our cat Scarlett, I don't give a damn. Who cares? I don't like ABC News. It's all infotainment anyway.
Okay,
so this is not the biggest topic.
All right, let me say this. That's neither here nor there, but let's pick up on Michael's point. And my producer said I inadvertently said Bob Woodward. It's Woodruff. I should note Bob Woodward being the great journalist for The Washington Post. But this being said, Michael brings up an interesting point. He's given Katie Couric a ratings boost before she even got there. Mm-hmm. The interesting point here will be whether or not people will, in fact, watch who clearly has been a supremely popular figure in the morning. That's Katie Couric moved to this evening chair, Julianne.
And I think that that's interesting. I mean, I was watching Katie this morning in a Garden interview with Al Gore talking about his presidential prospects, and it was clearly a very soft interview. That doesn't play after 6 o'clock. And that's going to be the issue, is whether
very
or not
little
she can
plays
be hard,
after 6 o'clock these days.
Be a hard journalist after 6 o'clock. So I think that that's a lot of what's going on. But I do think that ABC pulled the plug a little too quickly on Elizabeth Vargas. And I think that she had a lot going on, and they should have given her more of an opportunity.
Well, she
to come
pulled
back.
The plug on herself. She took herself out of the chair.
Well,
her big belly
Michael,
with her.
Michael Myers with true insight. Michael, you were walking a fine line with this big belly thing. I'm
you know,
everybody.
I mean, see,
all right, Michael Myers.
And I wish we were in the same studio so I could get it.
Glenn Lowry, thank you so much. Greatly appreciate it. Next
thank
up
you.
On News and Notes, winning the hearts and minds of Iraqis, author Aaron Glentz says the U.S. may have missed its chance. And we hear from a black Sunni Muslim on life in America during the war on terror.